Welcome, everyone, to episode 325 of After the Credits. I am one of your co-hosts, Marina Antunes, joined today by fellow co-hosts.
Steve Stebbing.
Bill Harris.
And Melissa McDowell.
How's everybody doing?
Doing all right.
Doing all right.
Yeah. Haven't seen a lot since the last one, so that should be quick.
Well, before we go into the movies, happy belated birthday.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much. Yeah. Yeah, I'm older. You don't celebrate birthdays like you did past, I don't know. I think saying 35 is pushing it. But it's been a while since celebrating birthdays was a thing.
I just like getting cool fun stuff.
I don't want to talk about my alcoholic past, but until the age of 24, every year I went up, I would do the amount of shots of my birthday. So if I turned 24, I would do 24 shots. I'm not a proud man.
24 is where it ended.
It did. It was a very bad year.
Probably for the best, I think.
Yeah.
Probably for the best.
Yeah.
I don't know if anybody could live through, 35, 40 shots.
Oh my God.
Somebody up there could, but, okay. But now let's talk about some movies. And the movie of the week is Rebel Ridge, which I think at this point everybody could have seen. It's on Netflix, so it's widely available, which is good because I haven't really managed to get out to the theaters. But let's talk about Jeremy Saulnier's new movie.
Yeah, this movie feels like the most return to form for him since Green Room, in my opinion. Without Aaron Pierre, who I found out is like a late addition, that John Boyega had a lot of the movie filmed and then left citing family emergency. But there's a bunch of story to that. I think this is a real star maker for Aaron Pierre as well, who I'd only known from Old. And it's hard to gauge him in that film because the script is just so bloody awful that, I mean, even Rufus Sewell's not good in that movie. But there is some fireworks in this movie that really get me, especially the pace scene with him and Don Johnson is just chef's kiss stuff.
I mean, Don Johnson is amazing in this movie.
Oh, yes.
Like, when has he ever played a bad guy before? Has there been a time?
Probably in a Django.
Okay. Yeah, but yeah. I mean, he is so good here, and he just chews up scenery like nobody's business. Mm-hmm. Saulnier is a really good filmmaker, though, so it's not too shocking that this is as good as it is. It just feels like this little movie that nobody was talking about, and then all of a sudden, it's like the trailer dropped, it was coming out, and it was a buzz everywhere. This is the only thing anybody was talking about in the week leading up to the release. And now it's been available for like a week and a half. And I think it's still in the Netflix top 10, but it's lost a lot of the buzz, which is a bit disappointing. This really should have gone theatrical first.
Yeah, this is a year's best for me. This film's fantastic, thoroughly fantastic.
We've gone like 2 or 3 minutes without mentioning Iron Maiden.
Yes, opening.
Yes. I think I might have texted you, Bill. Any movie that opens with Iron Maiden is already winning.
And talk about hooking the audience within the first moments of the movie. Like, it's so dynamically done that you want to know what's next. Mm-hmm. And then they keep doing that. They keep kind of upping the ante. And it's like a thinking man's slow burn actioner, really.
Oh, very much so. That ending with the non-lethal equipment, there's a word for it that just escaped my mind. I thought the buildup and the execution of that scene is so impressive because you don't really think about it. But then you see all of these, you know, flare guns and smoke bombs and flash grenades going off. And you're like, how is this not hurting people? Like, it seems so against what it's supposed to be used for. I mean, besides the fact that this is a really solid action film, though Dan did say it reminded him of First Blood, which
it does.
For sure.
It
okay.
Yeah.
Which I haven't seen, so I don't know.
Oh, it's such a massive callback to Rambo. Like, I that's what got my partner actually into watching it with me. And then he's like, "Oh, this is Rambo." I was like, "Well, no," but he's like, "Yes, yes, it's Rambo." So
that's such a great conduit. Yeah. I love it.
Yeah, it was the Iron Maiden and the Rambo gold Craig on the film.
The Iron Maiden's playing, then he has this gnarly bike crash, or it's just like he rolls over and he's all bloody. And Emery Cohn, who has quite possibly one of the most punchable faces in the history of film,
he's always such a creepster.
Yeah, he's such a bastard in this film. He's so good, like just a real unlikable character. All the cops are kind of except for the one, but that's a bit of a spoiler. But yeah, no, it's a really fun film. I thought Saulnier's last film wasn't very good. But yeah, as you guys were saying, this is a big return to form. Mm-hmm. I think I still think Green Room is probably his best film. But this one, I think, is going to be underrated. And you're right, this should have been theatrical. Netflix is constantly losing money on these things. Like, there's enough fans out there who would have paid for this.
Yeah, I think so too.
Yeah, it's kind of sad. And yeah, Aaron Pierre is a star.
Yeah,
just a good looking dude with really nice eyes. That's all I got. I'm in tune with my sexuality, and I can say that he's just a good looking guy.
It's a solid performance too, though. Like, yeah, he does emote quite well, and the fact, I mean, and he is built. Jesus, like, do not mess with that guy. And if you think you can beat him at something, you are on another planet.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And a shout out to Anna Sophia Robb, who I didn't think was still acting, to tell you the truth, but she just shows up in this film.
Yeah, she's really good. She's really solid in it too. Yeah. Emery Cohen's come a long way since Brooklyn, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Holy crap. Aaron Pierce is somebody that they should not fumble. He's really good.
I think this movie's going to make him. Mm-hmm. which is great. I think this is what's going to launch him into superstardom. And yeah, he's just so intensely watchable and so sympathetic. Like, you're just on his side right from the very beginning. And one of the things I thought was so interesting about this film is the subtext of race. Like, at no point does this become overtly racist, but there's always that subtext playing there with this black main character and all these white cops. And even the interplay between him and the black female cop as well is just really interesting. There's just so much there that is not in the script, but it's performed so well. Like, I just think there's so much to his performance that's physical and unspoken that really comes across, and I was really blown away by that. I'm not sure I like this film as much as you did, Steve. I think, like, in terms of pacing and tension, this just wasn't as, like, Green Room had me at the edge of my seat, like clutching my throat pretty much the whole time. And this is not quite as full throttle as that, but it could have been. Like, I think this maybe suffered a little bit in the editing, perhaps. From what I understand, they filmed a lot more of the kind of, because the martial art that he was practicing is mostly like grappling, like kind of wrestling and stuff. And they filmed like a lot more scenes of him like taking down officers. But in the end, Saulnier decided that it didn't work. Because it's incredibly cool, but filming it is really problematic, I guess. I think the film suffered a little bit in terms of pacing and tension. But the performances are so solid and the story is so compelling that it's still a really great watch.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. And was it Macon Blair's brothers did the music for the film as well?
Yep. Yeah, I think it's a really good movie. I'm happy Saulnier's out of director jail, because there was nobody really knows why he got kicked off True Detective. He filmed two episodes and was supposed to film three, and just nobody's talked. So I'm happy he's back to directing and back to where he belongs. I just wish it was a theatrical film. I think he's that damn good, actually.
Which season was it for?
The Mahershala Ali one.
Oh, okay. Season 3?
Yeah, I think okay. so. Yeah, the first two episodes. He's supposed to do 3.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Wow.
And just to touch on what Melissa said about the pacing for me, I found it a little bit too long. And it doesn't keep that energy going for the entire running time. Like there were, especially in the second act, I think there was quite a bit that needed to be tightened up a little bit more. But overall, I still really enjoyed it. I mean, and though it didn't, the reason that Dan watched it wasn't because it was First Blood. That's the first thing that he said when the movie was over. He's like, that was like a First Blood remake. Okay.
just not in the forests of BC.
Yeah. Yeah. It could have been. I mean, he was like bushwhack camping there off his bike, which is impressive as shit too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I also just love like this story. I mean, this is where I think Saulnier shines and makes me wonder if maybe this had something to do with the True Detective stuff. I mean, he's a writer director. And like he wrote this script and this storyline, like this whole, it like it's based in what I'm sure is actually happening in a lot of small town America where their budgets are shrinking. You know, like this, the storyline itself of this kind of corrupt police department that's been kind of pushed into this. It's either they do this or they're going to fold up shop and it's going to be federal police coming in. Like you can just see that playing out in so many small towns across North America. So it just seems so plausible. And it's like just another thing we got to watch. We have to watchdog the police on, I guess. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I thought that was such an interesting idea, such an interesting plot point.
Actually interesting you mentioned that because I don't know if any of you are watching The Perfect Couple on Netflix.
I watched episode 1 yesterday.
Yeah, but one of the things that comes up by the time you get to like episode 3 is actually this concept of, you know, police departments and who's actually funding these police departments. So it's interesting mm-hmm. that you bring that up because that show tackles something very similar in a completely different way. Yeah. But it's still like on theme with this concept of how are police departments actually being funded and what does that mean for the communities that they're supposed to be protecting?
And it brings a complexity to the antagonist as well.
For sure. For sure it does. Yeah.
Well, it's also, I mean, I do think there's some danger there because I think this narrative that we don't fund police enough is ridiculous. I mean, City of Vancouver is a perfect example. Like a ridiculous portion of our city budget goes to the VPD, and I would argue for not, you know, particularly great service. I mean, I think the public has an expectation that the police are there to help prevent crime from happening, but they aren't. They aren't. That's not why they exist. They protect private property and they, you know, they deal with the aftermath of crime. And so it's really disappointing to me that we're at this point in society where this is like a huge talking point where we need to be funding police more to reduce crime when in fact we need to be spending a lot more on social programs, that keep people out of poverty, in order to attack the root causes of crime. So when I see these kinds of films that again, like, you know, like I think the way that Saulnier is approaching funding of the police and perhaps Perfect Couple too, that's not necessarily the angle that they're taking, but I do worry that when we start talking about like underfunded police departments, and I say that in air quotes for those of you listening at home, that is kind of like a dangerous narrative to start down, just because it's so prevalent on the right. Like like everyone's just calling for more and more police, which is not really going to solve any of our problems. But sorry, I'll get off my soapbox now.
But I mean, it's something to talk about because I mean, it is certainly pertinent to the discussion and to the film and to what Saulnier is touching on, probably much more than the silly show on Netflix. But yeah, I thought this was really good and it's definitely worth looking at. And for nothing else, to see Aaron Pierre star in a star making performance and Don Johnson just being an asshole. I love Don Johnson.
Don Johnson is best when he's being an asshole.
He totally is. He's plays a great asshole. He just has a very punchable face.
I don't know. He looked pretty good in a pink suit.
Listen, nobody said he's not looking good, but his face is still very punchable. Okay. So I think it's safe to say we all, to some degree, really liked Rebel Ridge and would recommend it. I would certainly recommend it.
I would recommend it for sure. I think people should see this movie.
It's definitely one of the better things on Netflix, for sure. Like one of the better things that Netflix has actually put out on Netflix. So, yeah.
Oh, I have something good that's on Netflix that we'll talk about at the end.
Oh, God, I have something terrible.
Well, I probably have the same terrible thing as well.
Yeah. And if anybody's curious, and if you're a disc collector, Green Room's available on 4K in the UK from Second Sight, and the disc is immaculate. Ooh. It's such a beautiful transfer. That movie rules.
Yes, it does.
And
I saw it at SFU Woodward at VIF.
I saw it at the Rio. Yeah.
Was I with you guys? I don't remember.
I don't know. It was a packed house. I was like upstairs in the balcony for that one. Some people walked out because it was so intense. Like that's the thing. Like that was for me what was missing from this. Like I agree with you, Bill, that this was totally a return to form for Saulnier, but the tension level in Green Room was like through the roof. And that's kind of what I was missing. And same thing with Blue Ruin. Like it's again, like the just high levels of tension. And I feel like this wasn't quite up to that same par. Another good plug for physical media on Green Room. I recently rewatched Green Room on Amazon Prime, a couple months ago. And I'm pretty sure they cut the machete scene.
What the fuck?
Like it's still there, but it's suggested and not nearly as graphic as I remember it in my head. And so like part of me is like, did my brain fill in the gaps when I saw the movie the first time? Or was that actually a fairly graphic scene and they cut it out for Prime?
I remember it being pretty graphic.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
So it's not just my brain playing tricks on me. Five physical media folks. They mess with your stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. Nazi punks, fuck off.
Yeah, pretty much. Okay, so who wants to go next with what they've been watching?
I can rock it. I can do it. So I got this in advance because it's playing in limited release before its Netflix release on September 20th. But Azazel Jacobs' new film, His Three Daughters, with Natasha Lyonne, Carrie Coon, and Elizabeth Olsen. And this movie was just fantastic. I mean, from the opening shot in, it's all three of these actresses playing so hard into what they're really good at. Carrie Coon is the snappy, like, pressure cooker sister. Natasha Lyonne is the slacker, pot smoking one that hasn't moved out of her dad's place. And Elizabeth Olsen is like this former acid head that's, you know, flighty and happy all the time and always leaning into her mothering and stuff. And it's so well written. I like Azazel Jacobs. I kind of late to his stuff. Like Kino sent me The Good Times Kid a while back. And then I saw the one with Deborah Winger and Tracy Letts, I think, called The Lovers. And I enjoyed that one. But I think this is his better film, in my opinion. And it's because this trio of performances, I really thought it was great. And this one is got super panned. And I don't know, my wife and I just had so much fun watching it. But The Front Room, the Eggers Brothers film with Brandy. And Brandy's the lead, but this is Catherine Hunter's movie, without a doubt, who plays the stepmother-in-law from hell that communes with the voice of God. And it's such a, like, it's like Rosemary's Baby light, kind of, but it's just done in enough of a ridiculous folk house horror way that I really kind of dug this film. And then I go online and it's like rotten. And they said it's A24's worst release they've ever put out. And I'm like, I don't know. I didn't feel that really. But I don't know. I enjoyed it. And a film that I enjoyed far more than I thought I was going to, given that it's a film 36 years after the original film. I had a fun time with Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice. It's probably Tim Burton's best thing he's done in over 20 years, probably. But it's still not like phenomenal, but it was a nostalgic kind of continuation of an old story that still worked to me and didn't feel super forced. Though it has a couple plot lines that just kind of are wrapped up so easily, you wonder why they were problems in the first place.
It's almost like they were trying to extend the running time of that movie, because
it is.
It's not very long, but I agree. For me, this was also probably the best thing I've seen from him in a number of years that I've enjoyed. My niece and I both said it was a 7 out of 10. Dan was like, it's a 4. Dan did not care for it.
He did not.
No, he was not impressed by it at all. I thought that there was, like, story-wise, it's kind of this very silly movie. I mean, can you even say it's a sequel to Beetlejuice other than the fact that it has, like, some similar characters? Mm-hmm. The part that I probably enjoyed the most were all the super, like, crazy parts. Like, Beetlejuice telling his story in Italian.
It was a Bava movie?
Yeah, like, it's such a genius move, and it's so, like, old Tim Burton. Like, let's take this wild swing, and maybe it'll work. And it does. Like, it's weird. And it's crazy, but it's like, oh, that's actually kind of fun. And that's why it's appearing.
And physical effects. I'm really endeared by the physical effects. I mean, simple things. I love that Winona Ryder is top lining a film in 2024. Yeah. Like, that's really fucking awesome. Catherine O'Hara reminds you that Moira Rose came before Moira Rose. There was Beetlejuice in 1988. So she's right back in that. There's a quick little crows thing in the movie with Catherine O'Hara that I thought was funny. Jenna Ortega just does what she does best. And Willem Dafoe's there to chew scenery.
He is having a moment. Like, how many movies is he in this year? Like, we saw that and I said, Dan, Jesus, this guy is like fucking everywhere.
Yeah.
Like, his career has not been this good in what? Like, maybe ever?
Yeah.
Has he ever been this busy?
I think sporadically here and there.
Who deserves it more than him? Like, honestly,
I agree.
He's always great. Every single thing he does, he's such a brilliant character actor.
Yes, mm-hmm.
I mean, his face is just like, who else on the planet looks like him? No one. It's just so great watching him on screen.
Agreed.
On screen, I love it.
I still think my favorite Willem Dafoe performance from this year is the third story in Kinds of Kindness.
We'll talk about that later.
Where he's wearing the banana hammock and with the tan, and oh my god, it's so
it's
good.
So and creepy as fuck.
I think that Tim Burton only put Monica Bellucci in it to satiate like a crush or something, because she is like almost nothing in the film.
And they're dating.
Oh, are they?
Are they really?
Oh, I had no idea.
I'm not joking.
Okay.
Explains a lot.
Okay, that does explain a shitload, actually. Bob's the MVP of this movie.
Yeah. I love Bob. She went from Vincent Cassell to Tim Burton.
Yep.
I thought this movie was pretty milquetoast. Not a lot of original ideas in this one. It's just more of the same, and it's fine.
That's
about it. It's just fine. I kind of expected more from a sequel, and it's made a ton of money. I don't quite know why. Did people have this Beetlejuice nostalgia that I didn't know about?
Oh, dude, we went on the Thursday night before it opened, and there was like people in costume.
Wow.
My niece was beside herself. She was so excited. She's like 7, okay? She wanted to go see it because she's a huge Jenna Ortega fan. She's like, Wednesday is in this movie. I'm like, okay.
Well, what I was going to say, I don't think it's Beetlejuice. I think it's a combination of Beetlejuice nostalgia meeting the juggernaut that is the star of Jenna Ortega.
Like, yes.
Yeah. She's just so huge with the younger set. Like, this was like a slam dunk. It's the perfect aesthetic for her, perfect vehicle for her. and it gets all the parents. So
yep. Yep. There were a lot of families at that screening.
No.
At a 7 p.m. show on a Thursday night.
and this is the episode of Punchable Faces, because Justin Theroux has a really punchable face.
I love him.
That slick back hair he's
got. Oh, so good.
Oh, yeah. So good.
Yeah. I rewatched my True Lies 4K. That movie still slaps, but it's definitely a movie done through the mid-90s male gaze. In so many ways, like
that movie is so good. The fact that it's finally on 4K is a blessing,
and it looks, it looks so good.
Cause you are an eggplant.
It's so good. I'm Bill Paxton in that.
Oh my god!
Oh my god! I love
just him driving around in that. I think it's a Corvette, right?
Yeah, so good. The convertible.
It's so good. It's so fucking good.
Yeah.
Like, this is definitely the star of the show, and he's not.
No, I would watch a movie of his character, though, for sure. Oh, Simon. Yeah. Simon.
Oh, for sure.
This is embarrassing, so I'm going to say it right here. I've never seen The Descendants before. Alexander Payne's The Descendants. And I love, this is probably one of my favorite George Clooney performances. He's so fucking good in this movie. He's so good that he outacts people in the same scene as him, mostly Shailene Woodley, this was like her beginning, right? So whatever, it's fine. It's really, really solid movie. And I'm sad that I let it skip my brain for all these years now, because it came out in 2011. So it's like, where the fuck have I been? I also watched The Critic recently with Ian McKellen, a film very much written for Ian McKellen. It feels like he plays a theater critic that kind of gets embroiled in murder and revenge plots within the theater scene. And besides him, the movie is so bland and has like no depth to it whatsoever, which is a bummer because Gemma Arterton's in it. And I really like her. Mark Strong is in it, and I dig him a lot. And the kid that was in Harry Potter, that was also in that How to Get Away with Murder series with Viola Davis, he's in it too. And everyone's just kind of okay, because McKellen, every time he's on screen, he's Sir Ian, so he just kind of brings it. One of the big ones that I watched, my last theater screening was the remake of Speak No Evil, which is the Danish film from 2022. And I, heading into this, seeing this movie, I was so nervous because the original Speak No Evil, like, unsettled me. The ending is so bleak and harsh and just kind of leaves you almost in a cinematic trauma way, that I was kind of scared about this one, honestly. And knowing that James Watkins was directing it made me a little trepidatious as well, because Eden Lake is so brutal and harsh and ugly. And I mean, they're both really, really great films. But the internet already hates this movie, because I think they screened the trailer way too many times, and to the point that they're saying that James McAvoy is a terrible actor. I disagree. He's so great in this movie, and he's so on the edge of unsettling before he falls right off of it. And I also really like Scoot McNairy and Mackenzie Davis, who are great in this one. And Aisling Franciosi is in this, and I enjoy her. I came out this one really, really liking it. It's so awkward. It's unsettling and still has like a dark edge of humor to it. Me and my buddy were kind of laughing at intervals through this movie, because it just does go so over the top in some parts, and probably one of the tensest scenes I've ever seen that had the soundtrack of Cotton Eye Joe.
Wow. Okay. So I have a question.
Yeah.
I haven't seen this, but I've seen the original.
Mm-hmm.
Did they pull it back a little bit?
Yes.
Okay. Just asking.
Yes.
That movie is nuts.
It's hard. When I say cinematic trauma, I really do mean that. There are certain movies that when you think about it, you have like a whole, like in your mind, shudder, like, ugh. you know, and that's one of them. It is one of them. Yeah. It is such a heavy. Had we all seen Speak No Evil, the original?
No, no? I've okay. just added it to my watch list.
Okay, I don't want to get into it then. It's on Shudder. It's whew.
Yeah. Well, that's cool. I did want to see it. I just ran out of time.
Yeah. Yeah. I like it.
Cool. Yeah, I was hoping to see it over the weekend and it just didn't work out. So it's still on my watch list.
One more I watched last night and I hadn't seen it before. It's another one that's embarrassing me. I watched Sofia Coppola Somewhere. And
I love that movie.
It's so good. It's so, so good. Why did I sleep on this movie for so long? I really, really, really like it.
Where's that dwarf been?
Oh, I know. And so where did good. He's got to come back because that performance is the last scene. Like, oh, there's so much good stuff in that film. And it shows where Sofia can be a really, really, really great director.
Yeah.
Sadly for me, that doesn't always come through.
No, I agree.
That's
oh,
it.
Yeah. I'm like, have I seen this? Yes, I've seen this. Okay.
It's so good. And I love the Chateau Marmont stuff, like a lot. And just the absurdities of things that happened in that movie. Just how the massage scene, like that. I was dying in that scene. I so funny. So, so, so funny. Did it tell you?
Yeah. Sophia is very hit or miss for me. Like two or three masterpieces and a bunch of okay movies.
I don't like The Bling Ring, like at all. At all.
I thought that was okay.
And Priscilla, I'm 50-50 on.
Yeah, I'm not definitely bad. Not one of my favorites.
Priscilla is, I mean, really, it's the Kaylee Spaney factory, like factor for that film. Like she's so good in it.
Yeah.
But yeah, the film is in many ways disappointing.
And I don't like Jacob Elordi in that film, and that's why. Then I saw Saltburn after, and so I was like, oh, okay.
Yeah,
he is actually okay. Okay.
Yeah, he's not Elvis, but he's okay.
Yeah, exactly. I didn't feel his Elvis whatsoever.
Jacob Elordi, you mean 3 years ago with Glenn Powell?
He's no Glenn Powell. Let's be honest.
He was never Glenn Powell. Glenn Powell always played smarmy assholes. Jacob Elordi, like, he's like the guy that you're not supposed to be attracted to because he is an asshole. Like that's yeah.
No, you're right. It's a different type of asshole.
Those are very different archetypes.
Well, I watched some stuff. I think I might have texted Bill through all of this because I was very confused about Kinds of Kindness.
Mission accomplished.
I think overall it didn't work for me. The third story, I didn't realize it was three stories, so that confused me to begin with. I still don't know how they're interconnected if they're supposed to be, because I don't get it. If there is some sort of connection beyond the fact that it's a group of very talented actors all playing different roles. Maybe I'm just too dense. I didn't get it. But no, the third story is fucking gold.
I don't think there is connection.
Okay, good. Because the third story is fucking gold. I would have watched like a 90-minute movie, a two-hour movie about that weird cult. Because that cult was fucking weird. But so, so good.
What was with her driving in that, by the way?
I don't know, but I love it
so hard. Yeah.
Every time that car, like, I think it opens with her in that car, going like down the road, and you're like, the fuck, is this the same movie? And then the fact that this is on Disney Plus is just a chef's kiss.
Yeah. How many people have been assaulted by that film?
I hope everybody.
Yeah,
it was like everybody that had no idea.
Oh yeah, for sure, because it was like new releases, and you flip through all the new stuff, and Kinds of Kindness is up there, and you're like, "Oh,
I love Emma Stone."
Yeah, but... right. Yeah, and prepare yourselves.
Yeah,
and it's
funny. Core Things is also on Disney.
Yeah,
yeah, true. Yeah. Oh yeah, for sure. To me, it's just every time I'm kind of shocked by some of the stuff that ends up on there, because it is, they own so much crap. It's just funny that you get to watch all of your Disney classic movies and then, you know, something that's going to fuck you up. I also think it's hilarious to me that the best, well, what I think is the most, the strongest of the stories is the last one. Because how many people made it to that 2 hour mark? Because the first two are so, like, it's hard to get through. Like, I wasn't sure I was going to be able to finish the movie. Like, power through.
I really like the first story.
No.
No? Okay. The second one I will give you is not as good, but I still don't think it's bad either. It's just not as good as the third one.
No, and the thing is, like technically they're all great and the performances are great. I couldn't connect with any of it. Like, it was just this like exercise in watching a Yorgos Lanthimos movie that just was not working for me. And then I felt like vindicated because the third story is so good. And Hong Chao is fucking amazing. I love her.
I think
better in all the movies.
This one is more Alps than anything else. Like Alps, he's trying to piss you off. And this one, I think he's trying to piss you off.
Agreed.
And as I said, when I saw it like 2 months ago, I said, I warned you guys about this one. It's a little strange.
Mm-hmm.
And, not people are not going to like it, but I thought it was pretty cool.
My first film, Zia Anger's new movies. So this is interesting. I don't know if you guys know about this. So 15 years ago she made a movie that she made for like no money, submitted it to a bunch of festivals, and it was rejected by every single festival that she put it in. So the movie never got seen by anyone. So she made this first movie that is literally like rotting in a basement because nobody has ever seen it other than herself and the crew that worked on it. So a few years ago, I guess as therapy, she started doing this roadshow where she kind of had a theatrical one-woman performance about the making of that movie. And she's now made a movie about the making of the movie that nobody got to see. And it's actually really good. It's super meta, but Odessa Young kind of plays the fictionalized version of Zia Anger, and she's really good. And it's kind of this like meditative movie about this filmmaker who is looking back at the experience of making her first movie. So it's almost like a therapy session on like getting over the fact that you spent years making this movie that nobody got to see. It's interesting. I really enjoyed it. I thought it was pretty good. A bit weird, but very, very low budget, but pretty good. It's worth checking out. And I have zero interest in watching her first film. Nice. Like,
I haven't even heard of this.
Yeah, I saw somebody talk about it and I thought, well, that sounds interesting. And it turned out to be pretty good. I really rather enjoyed it. Aditi, which I think, Bill, you might have talked about on the last show. This felt like my youth. I actually looked it up. I'm like, why is this the 2000s? This feels like the late 90s. I was very confused about the timing. But either way, it kind of captures this period of time where, and I'm still curious about how they managed to get like old Facebook. I'm sure it's probably on like the internet database or some archive somewhere. But man, it was a little bit shocking.
Wasn't that like AOL Instant Messenger or something like that? Or
yes. Mind you, IRC was the thing when I was growing up, so maybe that was a little off. But that whole tech thing just was like nostalgia overload. But Isaac Wang is so good, but Joan Chen steals the show. She is amazing, and I just wanted to cry every time she was on screen. She kind of just reminded me of like my mom, and it kind of hit home in a weird way. So yeah, this movie is really, really good.
I know I said last episode that I was pretty okay until the final scene where I just started crying uncontrollably. Yeah.
I cried before that. I had problems. Austin Peters' skincare with Elizabeth Banks. Elizabeth Banks plays this very popular, very famous, like Hollywood skincare expert who is trying to launch her own skincare line, except things on the surface are like Hollywood, right? On the surface is not the reality of things. And she's basically like leveraging herself to the hilt to like launch the skincare line. And things just start to go wrong. Like, there's like another guy that moves into like two doors down in the development that she rents in, who's also doing skincare. And she thinks this guy's out to get her. And then shit starts to get like crazy. And she thinks this guy is really out to get her. Lewis Pullman also stars. And he has a very interesting storyline. This movie's unhinged. Like, Elizabeth Banks is crazy. She's very, very good. The movie is kind of all over the place, but I thoroughly enjoyed watching Elizabeth Banks lose her shit. And half the time you're like, is she imagining this? Like, is she legitimately crazy, or is somebody actually trying to like pull one on her? Because it's not clear until the very end of the movie. And then you kind of figure it out and you're like, oh, okay, that's what was going on. But it's crazy and it's pretty good. I mean, it's not great, but Banks is really good in a role that's not really like anything else she's been in before. So I would say it's definitely worth a look. It's interesting. The Exorcism with Russell Crowe. Okay. So did you guys talk about this movie?
Yeah.
I think Steve did. Yeah.
Yeah, I brought it.
Okay. That's just probably what, but I tell you what, this was far better than I thought it was going to be. I did not know what to expect. I thought the concept was actually pretty good and the execution isn't bad. It's kind of a mess at the end.
Yeah.
But man, this movie is actually not horrible. What the fuck?
It brings out the gore
out of
nowhere. You're like, okay. And because we reviewed this on my show and Chloe fucking hated this movie. She's not into this film at all, and it was really funny because I was like mildly entertained by it, but she was just like, nope, this movie is shit.
I actually thought the concept was kind of genius, because I mean, if you tell anybody you're gonna remake The Exorcist, you're like, what the fuck? Yeah. But I mean, and that opening shot is actually really effective. I was shocked. I liked this way more than I probably should have. And I thought it was better made than it had any right to be. I'm like, okay, it's not terrible. Take it for what it is, but I thought it was okay. I actually kind of liked it.
It's part of Russell Crowe's exorcism point in his career.
Sure.
Was this the one with David Hyde Pierce in it? That,
yeah. Yes.
Marina? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
How was David Hyde Pierce?
Old.
Yeah.
It was an old priest.
It was
a little bit shocking because I haven't seen him in so many years. I think the last thing I saw him in was that little indie time travel movie, the name of which escapes me now, which was now probably like 10 years ago. So it's a little bit shocking to see him now. And you're like, where have you been this entire time? I mean, he's not bad. Like, the performances here are not bad. The movie is just kind of weird. Like, the concept is a bit strange. It's pretty well put together, but like, just the idea of it is kind of strange. And then you have these like basically character actors and you're like, I don't know what to make of this. So it's a bit of a mess, but yeah, like it gets, I thought he was fine. The performances I actually thought are pretty good. The movie is meddling, but it's still far better than it has any right to be.
And here's a PSA from the After the Credits podcast. Watch the first Omen. It's a lot better.
Yes. Agree. 110%. 110%. Baltimore, also known as Roses War. I'm sure it's also AKA as something else. Who knows? I think this thing has been probably meddling for a while. Christina Milloy and Joel Laylord's new movie. They did Rose Plays Julie a number of years ago, which I think I saw VIF and I really, really liked. So this is the real life story of a British national from a very wealthy family who sells her apartment in London, gives the money to the IRA, decides that she's going to become an IRA operative, and then is involved in the Russell Brout House incident, where they stole like 19 classic paintings that have never reemerged, other than a couple that have reemerged since. But they were basically going to trade the paintings for IRA operatives that were being held in custody by the British government. So it's based on a true story. It's basically a heist movie that plays like a thriller, like very, very heavily like a 70s thriller. It's set in 1974, but it's also like a biopic about the character whose name is Rose. I've forgotten her last name. I didn't write it down. It's really good. I don't know where this movie's been hiding, but I can see maybe why it hasn't gotten a lot of attention, because it's kind of it's a little bit messy. It's not 100% sure what it wants to be. Like, part of the time it's a thriller, part of the time it's a biopic, part of the time it's a heist movie. But I thought it was really, really effective. And Imogen Poots gives a great performance. And the cinematography in this movie is like chef's kiss. It is so good. Highly recommend it. I think this has been slept on. It's a really solid movie. Really solid.
I'm so interested in this one for sure.
Yeah, it's really, really good.
You had me at Imogen Poots.
Yeah, exactly.
She's fantastic. She's fantastic. Treasure. This is Julia von Heinz's new film with Lena Dunham and Stephen Fry. So I think it's based on a book of a woman, a music reporter. I think it probably takes place in the 80s, maybe the late 70s. So Lena Dunham plays a music reporter who decides she's going to travel to Poland to sort of reconnect with her family. And her father decides he's going to tag along. So he's a Holocaust survivor, as was her mother. And so for her, it's a story about reconnecting with her roots. And for her father, it's a story about reliving this traumatic past that he thought he had left behind. Lena Dunham isn't great. Stephen Fry is pretty fantastic. The movie is okay, I guess. It's interesting to see her in a movie that she hasn't written. I don't know. I'm kind of on the fence about it. I'm not really 100% sure how I feel about it, but I thought it was okay at best.
So shitty Tony Erdmann?
Yeah. Sure. Yeah, I could go with that.
Yeah. That's what it sounded like to me.
Yeah, that's kind of what it is. That's kind of what it is. I mean, it's not bad. It's just also not great, and it's not really that memorable. But Stephen Price's performance is really, really good. And Dunham has a couple of moments that are affecting, but overall I didn't think the movie was really working for her, and it kind of felt like she was just playing another version of the character she always plays, which is this kind of like awkward, socially inept person who wants to fit in but doesn't really know how and tries too hard. I don't know, it didn't work for me. I did watch The Crow. I literally finished it this morning. I didn't think it was as horrible as you guys thought it was. I still didn't like it. It shouldn't be called The Crow, but it's not terrible. The performances are not good either, but technically it's actually not a bad looking movie. Though some of the story plot points I'm still not fully on board with. Like, there's way too much supernatural bullshit beyond the fact that like, what's his name actually, like, like the bad guy whose name I've forgotten?
Danny Houston?
Yeah. Danny Houston. Is he like a supernatural being? Like,
he's a guy that's like sold his soul that now has to suck other souls. I don't know.
This, like, there was a bunch of stuff there that I just don't understand. Dumb. But, yeah. Okay, so it's not good. But I didn't think it was horrible. Still not worth watching, probably.
Borderlands is worse, I would say, but The Crow is just egregiously bad.
I think that FKA Twigs has the worst performance I've seen.
It's so bad.
Yeah. She's so bad. Yeah,
I feel bad for her because she could do so much better. There are choices are made in this movie.
And her new song, when it kicks, like when it really kicks in, is a real banger. So she just released it on Friday. So
I might listen to it. And then the show that everybody should watch if you haven't seen it already on Netflix is Chaos. Because that show we finished it last night. I'm not really sure what I will do if Netflix does not renew this for a second season. I might kill somebody. No, I'm kidding. But holy shit, the show is super fucking good. Like, on another level good. It takes a super convoluted story of Greek mythology and brings it into a present where it's actually, like, relatable. And the performances... I don't even know. I don't think Jeff Goldblum has been this good in I don't know. He's in a lot of stuff, but he is really, really good here. And that trio of him, Hera, and Poseidon is like, you put the three of them on screen together, it's like the screen melts. It's just so good. It's so good. I don't know. This show is on another level. I need to watch it again. People need to watch this thing so we can get a season two.
It looks expensive.
Oh, and this is the problem, right? So as soon as it was over, I was like, okay, have they announced the season two? It was really expensive. And not enough people have seen it. It fell off the top 10 like very, very quickly. So the chances that it's going to get a renewal for a second season is probably slim to none, which is too bad because it is so good and it is left unresolved. I mean, if you know if you know the Greek mythology, you can figure shit out, but it's not the same, right? It's not the same because they really turned something that is really difficult to unpack and made it very, very entertaining. Charlie Covell is really good at what she does. I will watch whatever it is that she brings me next because this show is on another level. It is so good. So good. And that's all I got.
Once again, I haven't even heard of that. But
How have you not heard about a show with Jeff Goldblum and Zeus?
I've been busy. As you'll see in a second with how many movies I watched. I'll go next. I watched Wise Guy, David Chase and The Sopranos.
Oh, yeah.
It's pretty good. Sweet. David Chase is a weird dude. I had no idea. Other than the show, you kind of understand what when you watch The Sopranos that David Chase might be a little bit of a weird guy. But, he's super controlling. Everybody respects him but doesn't really like him. It was super sad. The Gandolfini stuff. I miss Gandolfini so much. And they showed clips from the funeral for Gandolfini where people were giving speeches about him, and it was super touching. It's good. It's just too long. It should have been one part. It's like 3 hours long. I don't think it needed to be 3 hours. It's not bad. Alex Gibney is a pretty good filmmaker. If you've seen his work, you know what this is. There's nothing major here. But it's super watchable. I watched because Oasis got back together, right? So I had to watch the Blur documentary. Blur to the End, where they reformed to play sold out shows at Wembley for three nights, and before they played the Wembley shows, they played warm up shows in small English towns at like churches and bars, and I thought they didn't like each other, but it turns out they all kind of really like each other. And it was kind of nice. Damon Albarn seems like a nice guy. Graham Coxon seems like a nice guy. I was quite shocked. It's quite nice, actually. They play really well. They like each other. The Oasis tour is going to blow up after three shows. And Blur just keep on trucking. It's quite funny.
It'll be like that. Did you see that Porno Papyrus blow up?
No, Jane's Addiction.
Oh, Jane's Addiction. Yeah.
It'll be like that.
Oh, well, and actually one of the Oasis brothers did comment on that. the follow-up has been amazing.
Liam loves Damon. They love each other.
I think it's really funny.
They're the best friends.
They were such heated rivals, and now they've like played together, and they love each other.
Yeah.
Interesting documentary. I quite liked it, actually. I saw a really crappy horror film called Hellhole. It's on Shudder from John Adams and Toby Poser, who made a really awesome film a couple of years ago called Hellbender. I don't know if you guys saw that one, but it's really good. It's maybe the worst film I've seen this year. The special effects are terrible. The story is terrible. It's about this company that's fracking, and they unearth some demon thing, and it comes up and it possesses people by going inside their body and controlling their bodies, and it's really terrible. The special effects are so bad. Shudder is in their like free Tubi movie phase right now. This one sucks. I'm not a fan, which sucks. I want it to be good. And last but not least, holy crap, speaking of the worst film of the year, Uglies on Netflix. I know I'm not the audience for this YA piece of shit, but it is just incredibly terrible.
No. Admittedly, nobody is the audience for this anymore, because the audience for this was back like 20 years ago when the movie, the book came out. Like, this is the, all of the reviews have said the same thing for a reason. This movie feels like it missed the boat by 10 years.
I didn't even know this was a book series. Like, I just assumed Netflix movie.
No. And the thing is, like, when Westerfield released that book, it was before The Hunger Games. It was before, like, dystopian YA was a thing. It, like, disrupted the industry. Like, it was a book that came out when YA was sort of starting to get really popular, because Twilight had come out, like, a couple of years before. And so people were like, what else is YA that's cool that we can be reading? And so he put out this series of books, and they were, like, altering, like, they shifted the discussion about what YA could be. And the books are really good. Like, it's a really, really good series that's really well written. The problem is, this should have come out 20 years ago when the books came out in the early aughts. Like, it's been in production hell for a decade. Like, it finally looked like it was going to get off the ground somewhere in the 2010s. At that point, it was already probably too old. And now we've seen all of the Hunger Games movies, all of the Maze Runner movies, all of the other shit that's been adapted from, like, lesser YA. And it just feels like old crap. Like, it just feels like recycled material. I agree. It's not good, but I think it suffers from the fact that it should never have been made. Like, it's, like, I don't know why they decided to make this now. Like, Netflix has apparently had this done for a couple of years, and they've been trying to figure out what to do with it. They should have just honestly released it without a big to-do, because nobody cares.
No, there's also something really problematic about calling Joey King ugly.
Well, this was going to be an issue anyways, right? Because, I mean, in the book, you can be whatever, like, there's nobody in this movie is fucking ugly.
I know. And that's a problem. Like,
of course it is.
Yeah.
I mean, the concept is problematic for any sort of adaptation that's visual. So this was a problem from the get-go, which I think was why it never got off the ground to begin with. But I didn't think it was the worst thing I've seen this year. I thought it was actually a pretty decent adaptation of the source material. It just feels out of place and out of time. Like, it just feels problematic for other reasons. Like, they should have just not. I mean, I'm not for one to make a movie and then, like, not release it. I'm glad that they've put it out. It's just, they've put it out now because Joey King is a name they can bank on, right? People are like, okay, we like her, we'll watch this thing. But it's not very good. But she definitely is the highlight. Her and Laverne Cox are the highlights of this movie. There's never going to be the sequels, which is totally fine. We don't need them.
Read the books. The books are really good. It might have been popular enough for them to make more, which
I don't think it. I don't think
pisses
it
me off. This movie, it looks really cheap too.
I mean, I'd be curious to see how much money they spent on the visual effects. I'm sure they spent some money on it, but not the budget of like a Hunger Games movie for sure.
And the first guy who got prettied, I thought actually looked worse pretty than he was normal. That was a bad choice. just not a very good film. Please avoid that one. Unless you've read the source material like Marina and had a weird fascination with it.
And even then, it's not
good.
No. I just think it needs context.
And also, did you notice it was directed by Joseph McGinty?
Oh, McGee?
Or as his douchey friends call him, McGee.
Has he made anything worthwhile ever?
Yeah, I was shocked when I saw that name on the end credit. I was just like, wow, I thought he was out of Hollywood. But I guess not. Because I guess this film was probably shot a while ago.
I don't think it's new. I think they've had it for like a year or two. Apparently they did reshoots. There's been a bunch of stuff associated with it, so I don't know. Not good. Read the book. It's better.
Yeah, totally. That's it for me.
Well, I'm going to be way shorter, you guys, because I'm like amazed Bill had so many things to report on, because I've been, since our last recording, I've been pretty much exclusively just been watching screeners for the Spark Animation Film Festival coming up. There were a record-setting 500 submissions this year. It was 44 hours of viewing. And I got to say, like, you think it's going to be super fun to watch 500 short films. And sometimes it is. Sometimes it gets a little tiring. I will say that there was nothing out of those 500 submissions. There was absolutely nothing terrible. The animation schools are doing some good work. The students are killing it. There's some really great animators out there. Everything was like good. So like sifting through it all to find stuff that was truly extraordinary was what made everything difficult. But yeah, there's some really great animators out there. I just, hope that they come up with some stories that are really worth telling.
Just for the record, the only reason I watch stuff is because I watched it like yesterday. Like until yesterday I had watched nothing other than Beetlejuice and Rebel Ridge.
I love that you just like marathoned like five films so you'd have something to talk about today.
Yeah, pretty much. That's exactly what happened.
I should have done that, but I think it was just, 500 after 500 short films, the last thing you kind of want to do is hit play on anything. I don't know. but yeah, so state of animation in the world today, probably we're headed for good things. Yeah.
Nice.
I love it. Actually, by the time this show goes live, we'll have sent out the press release, but we've announced the first titles for the Spark Animation Festival, and we're going to open with the Canadian premiere of Savages, Claude Barris's new movie. So there's that, which I'm very excited about. I had a chance to see that at Annecy, and it's very, very good, and I'm really happy that we're able to bring it to Vancouver. It's going to be fantastic.
I have to say, too, like, Spark really, like, I'm one of those adult Disney haters, you know, like I'm not, you know, like there's like adult Disney lovers who like watch every single Disney animated movie and they're like super obsessed with all of them. I am not that person. I'm like the antithesis of that person. So for me, Spark was my gateway into really looking at the possibilities of animation and the kinds of stories that can be told. And it's not all Disney and Pixar. I mean, there's nothing wrong with Disney and Pixar. It's just, you know, there's the possibility of telling much more mature, interesting stories. There's like definitely a lot of students coming out of animation schools right now who definitely have a horror bent, which is very exciting to me because I think it's a super fun medium for horror. If you think you don't like animation, two things: watch Robot Dreams, and also there is definitely animation out there for you. Don't write it all off, like I might have used to have done. Yeah,
I second both of those.
I'm also a little bit of a Disney hater because when I was a child, my brother, who's a couple years older than me, was really into anime, and he rented a little film called Grave of the Fireflies. And I was like, cool, animated film. And it destroyed us. And I've been a little bit weird since then. I was like 10 years old. So, even though I have heard really good things about The Wild Robot out of TIFF, people are saying that's one of the best films of the year. So I can't wait for that.
Oh, well, my 7-year-old niece says we can't go see it because it's going to make her cry.
I'm with Chloe. It does look like a movie that's going to make
First trailer made me fucking bawl my eyes.
Yeah, same. I'm like, same.
Come on. Yeah,
it got
me. I'm crying at a trailer.
Yeah, it nailed me.
Oh, damn it, Chris Saunders. Okay. Well, this is actually a good segue into part two of our podcast today, which is we're going to do a little bit of a preview of the Vancouver International Film Festival. So for those that might not know, we were all kind of in Vancouver or Vancouver adjacent, because Bill is definitely not in Vancouver and neither is Steve. Yeah. but VIFF is kind of like, it's the largest film festival in British Columbia, celebrating their 43rd anniversary this year, runs September 26th to October the 6th. So 2 weeks of movies and labs and workshops and Q&As and all the stuff that comes with festivals. So we thought we would count down, or not maybe count down, but share five titles that we're really excited about out of like the 300 and some odd movies that they're going to be screening over the course of 2 weeks.
I also had something in addition to that, because I also asked Chloe, my co-host, what her five that she was looking forward to as well. So
excellent.
Nice.
Excellent. Always good to get more recommendations, because I tell you, it is hard to sit through 300 movies.
I tried 1 year. It didn't work.
I did 62 my first year.
So does anybody know what the actual world record is for watching the most movies at a film festival is?
65
However many Bill has done.
During the Granville years, I was doing over 100 a year.
So you should look into this, because the reason I say this is, so TIFF is currently in full swing. There is the programmer for the Canada Screens program is trying to break the world record for most films seen at a film festival. And as of like earlier this week, he was at like 68. And I'm like, that is peanuts. Bill has definitely done more. Gotten like to 100. So Bill, I think this is all to say that I think you might've beaten a world record.
So when I did Fantastic Fest and Fifth back to back 1 year, and I tried to watch 150 at both festivals, and I got to 146, and my eyes really hurt. Shocking, right?
I remember this.
Also, okay, that was 146, and he took breaks from the film festival to go see movies at other theaters.
Yes, because Bill is crazy.
Was that the Joker year?
No, it was a couple years before that.
Okay.
Yeah.
So just a question before we get into what our picks are, but what year is this for you in attending? For me, it's my 9th year.
Oh God, do you really want to know?
Yeah. I'm interested.
22nd or 23rd.
See, I'm a newbie to it in comparison to you guys, for sure.
Yeah.
I have to do the math because I don't remember. For me, 27.
Damn.
97 was my first year at VIFF. As press.
That's awesome.
My first year at VIFF, I didn't really know how it worked, so I bought tickets. And we showed up for a weekend. And my first film I saw was a Korean film at the Vogue called Volcano High. And then I saw the Lucas Moodyason film, Lilia Forever, after it. And then we were like, okay, cool. We'll go over to the Vogue and see the special presentation of City of God. We'll be able to get tickets. We don't have tickets. It'll be fun. And we walked over there. There's 3,000 people in line. We're just oh, shit, we're buying a pass next year. Like, we learned pretty quick. VIFF can be a big animal at times.
Yeah.
My first VIFF movie, I still remember it, was Cube. It was a last minute. I was working at the UBC at the time because I was a UBC student. I was studying there. And I was writing for the paper I just started. And because I'd done a summer internship there. And the culture editor couldn't make the screening. So they called me like on a Saturday. And they're like, can you come to the screening and then interview the director tomorrow? And I'm like, okay. So that was my first VIFF experience, was watching Cube, and then the next morning talking to Vincenzo Natali, which is still a highlight. I still remember that very,
that's
very
awesome.
That movie still slaps, by the
it
way.
Does it does
still
slap.
Absolutely still does. Yeah. I like Natali.
Yeah.
Me too.
He made a really rad film at VIFF I saw called Nothing. Did you see that
movie? Oh, so good.
I've seen that movie.
Yeah. That movie rules. Yeah.
I gushed like badly after that Q&A. Yeah, I'm like, I don't know if you remember me, blah, verbal diarrhea right after. That movie is so good.
I think
it's still technically impressive. Sorry, Melissa.
Sorry, I was just going to say, I think my first year was 2009, because I didn't live anywhere near Vancouver until I moved here in 2007. So, 2009 was my first year. I was volunteering. And it was still the Granville 7 years, which I really miss, because it was like 7 theaters in one building. And it was so fun to have so much of the festival in one space. Like, even if you weren't rushing from movie to movie, which was so easy to do when it was all in one venue, the conversations in the lobby and like outside and lineups, it was just so nice to have everybody kind of in one space. So really miss that theater a lot just for the VIFF experience. I don't think I ever went to Granville 7 for movies outside of VIFF. But I loved going there for VIFF films. And I think, so what sold me on VIFF was Midnight. That was when they still did the Midnight Madness screenings. So they did like a late night screening of Ninja Assassin. and I still to this day, I fucking love that movie. It's so over the top ridiculous, but like Rain is just one of the most beautiful men on the face of the earth.
Bill and I were at that screening. I remember that screening.
Yeah.
And it was like, it was so fun. And I was like, this, I feel like it was, cause yeah, I was still sort of new to Vancouver, and Vancouver is a really weird city to like make friends and social connections in. And yeah, just sitting in that screening, I felt like, okay, these are totally my people. Like late night, ridiculous, over the top, gory action movie. These are my people. I found my people. And then it was like, I think just a couple years after that was when I met Marina through some friends. And then, yeah, Bill and Steve, you guys are my friends through VIFF. Like, yes. I know you because of VIFF.
Yep. Yeah.
So like, yeah, like the film festival has just been such a hugely enriching experience for me, mm-hmm. both as a volunteer, as the like friendships that it unlocked for me, and just finding a community of like movie loving people in Vancouver. It's been so great. So.
That's why I'm excited to bring a new generation into it. And then
yeah.
Melissa just brought this up, so I'll say it, but the reason I was able to see like 100 films is because it all was in one big theater with seven mm-hmm. screens, and yeah. you could literally go start at 10 a.m. and then see a midnight show, and there'd be like 3 minutes between each show.
Yeah,
you could see 7 or 8 movies a day easily.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, that's so it was nuts. Yeah, I think
the thing I loved the most about the Granville 7 was all these little nooks and crannies that you discovered. Like, not the first year, but maybe by like year 3, you know where to quote unquote hide so that they wouldn't boot you out of the theater, like the venue between movies. So like there was the mezzanine theater, I think it was Cinema 4, like up those weird stairs that you could just kind of like hide outside of. There was like this area in the basement next to a bathroom that you could like plug your phone in to charge your phone and do some work. Like I miss that venue so much.
My favorite thing was Theater 7 had like a front entrance by the screen.
Yes.
So you would, when the credits hit, you would walk in that, because there'd be nobody would be there, and you'd walk in there and then grab your seat and act like you were in the previous screening.
Yeah.
Yeah. Did that all the time.
I have so many VIFF stories, guys. We could go on.
Some tricks that no longer work because it's no longer a venue.
Yeah.
No. Okay. So let's talk about this year's festival. And I mean, I can go first. How do you guys want? Do you just want to like rattle off your list?
Yeah,
that's probably the easiest, that's right?
Yeah,
it's not like a countdown or anything. I have to be completely honest. Because I'm so busy with Spark, my list is very superficial. It's basically a lot of it is like big titles that I'm really excited about that I kind of want to see at the festival and that I've put on my schedule because they're movies that I really want to see and I might not have a chance to see them later in the year. But they are not really like discoveries. Like they're not movies that you're looking through page 49 of the program and go, oh, that looks really cool. Like I used to spend like an entire week reading the entire program, marking pages, building a schedule. Now it's like, what can I squeeze in? Usually it might be one or two movies a day if I'm lucky. So my list is, my list is very superficial. It'll surprise no one. So my 5 movies that I'm most excited to see are The New Steven Soderbergh Presents. I didn't need to know anything about this movie other than it's a movie by Steven Soderbergh. I will pretty much watch anything he makes. Doesn't matter how weird. It could be Bubble and I'll still watch it.
I think I read something really weird about this film. I heard it's maybe shot first person.
Yeah, from the point of view of the ghost.
Yeah.
I'm in. I was in at Steven Soderbergh. Like that's all I needed to sell me on this movie.
It's kind of weird that Soderbergh's in the altered states section, but I'm down with it.
Absolutely. Well, that too. The fact that he's making maybe quote unquote a horror movie, who knows? Like, honestly, all I needed was Steven Soderbergh and I'm there. I'll watch it. It just happens to work with my schedule as well, which is really a nice surprise for me. Anora, Sean Baker's Cannes winning film. because I was always going to watch a Sean Baker movie, regardless whether it won a prize at Cannes or not. Mm-hmm. I love that guy. I love his movies. I say watch any of his films. They're all fantastic. If you can find Prince of Broadway and take out his first two films, I highly, highly, highly recommend them. They both are good.
Both are in the Criterion Collection.
Thank you. Both worth checking out. He's just an exceptional filmmaker, and the fact that the rest of the world's caught up is just a nice bonus. So Anora was very high on my list. Amy Adams turning into a dog. Yes, please. Give me Night Bitch any day of the week. And that title. Come on. Come on.
Wasn't there like another film in the film festival just a couple of years ago called Bitch, where a woman turned into a dog?
I want to say you're right.
Yeah. Like, I'm sure it was part of the Altered States program. I don't know if it was based on the same book.
I think it was the Mariana Palka wrote and directed it, I think.
It didn't have Amy Adams, which is why I didn't see it.
It was also good, but...
Yeah.
Now, I love Amy Adams. I'm so stoked to watch this. The trailer is pretty good. Andrea Arnold's new movie, another filmmaker who I will watch pretty much anything of, regardless of what it is. So Bird was very high on my watch list. And then maybe the odd one out is Secret Mall Apartment, which just sounds fucking crazy. A documentary about a bunch of guys that built an apartment inside of a mall and basically kind of lived in it for 4 years. This just sounds so weird. I'm like, okay, bring it.
That's the first movie of my festival.
Me too.
We're both later, going to see that. Yeah.
I think it just sounds and looks amazing. I'm in. Those are my five.
Nice.
Good
picks.
Who's next?
Okay.
Well, no, I'll run
next.
At it.
Yeah, I'll go next. I mean, we have movies that cross over, like Bird for sure. I want to see Andrea Arnold's last film, I think, was Cow, documentary Cow, which is another one of those cinema trauma movies to me. The inevitable ending of that movie is still very painful.
All of Andrea Arnold's movies are cinema trauma. Like, let's be completely honest.
I just bought the Blu-ray Criterion of Fish Tank I got it for Christmas last year.
So good. I love that film.
Love that film so much. It fits well on my Criterion shelf with Ratcatcher, Lynn Ramsey's brutal film. Presence is on my list for sure. Soderbergh, exactly. And genre chef for Soderbergh, as Bill brought up. And Nora, like, there's no way I can miss this film. Especially like, because for me, my VIFF experience, besides I didn't get to see Red Rocket because I had to leave that year, but I mean, Florida Project I experienced at the center, and it annihilated me, just annihilated me entirely. But the two that I differ from that list, Alice Lowe's Time Stalker, which I'm seeing the opening night.
I'll see you there.
I'm so excited for this. I love Alice Lowe. I think her films are so interesting. Premature is a hell of a film.
Revenge
is a hell of a film. And I believe that was the last one she did.
Yeah,
The trailer for this that just dropped looks fucking insane. I'm like all over it.
Yeah. I'm so excited. And then A Different Man is for sure on my list. I'm hearing a lot of great stuff about this movie, and I'm very, very excited to check that out. So yeah, that's my five.
Do you want to do Chloe's?
Okay, sure. Chloe's list that she gave me here, Presence and A Different Man are both on that list, but she also has Brief History of a Family on this list that sounds really interesting. Seeds, which is an indigenous film. She's very much looking forward to that one. And one that we're actually going to check out at the VIFF theater screening of it. Marco, The Invented Truth is on her list as well. So
nice.
those are what she's excited about this year.
Phil, do you want to wrap things up, or do you want to go next?
I'll go. So I haven't ranked because I'm that guy. Number five, Night Bitch, just because I was kind of not into it because I kind of thought it might be a little strange. And then the huge reviews at a TIFF kind of swung me.
Did you not see the trailer?
I did see the trailer. Awesome. I saw it like, I've been watching shorts, Marina. Leave me alone.
I'm sorry. I forgot. Okay. I'm sorry.
But now I'm sold now. It looks pretty great. And everybody is saying Amy Adams is Oscar worthy. So I'm all over that. Number four, Emilia Perez, the new Jacques Audiard film, which I've heard is either going to really love it or you're really going to hate it. It's a musical. And it's not, I have two musicals on my top five. And that's really weird because I don't like musicals. I think Odiar is a genius. Un Prophet is quite possibly one of the greatest films I've ever seen. I love that film so much. Number three, Conclave, which I heard is very Succession-like.
I cannot wait. That's so good looking.
All over that. And supposedly Ralph Fiennes is incredible. Edward Berger's last film, All Quiet on the Western Front, was pretty cool. Mm-hmm. So I'm looking forward to that. Number two, the new Joshua Oppenheimer film, The End.
Mm-hmm. My festival ends with The End.
Nice. It's also a musical. I've heard it's also very polarizing, but it's got Tilda in it.
Yeah.
And it's got Michael Shannon in it. So I'm all over that. And number one, got to give props to Sean Baker, who mm-hmm. is pretty much lives in Vancouver. Like a bunch of times I've seen him at VIFF a bunch of times. I've seen him at the Rio all the time. I've talked to him a couple of times. He's a great guy. And I also must say that Marina was the first person I ever knew who Sean Baker was. I remember when we saw Starlet at VIFF, Marina's like, I've already interviewed him. I've seen two movies that he's already done. I'm just like, holy shit, you're like super into this. Anora is going to be great. Supposedly Mikey Madison is incredible, and I'm glad she lived after Leonardo DiCaprio lit her on fire, which is really good.
Yeah, he's resilient.
Yeah, super resilient. Yeah. I think second night of the festival or third night of the festival, so that's a really I hope Sean Baker's there because he deserves the love he's probably going to get if he shows up, and that's my list.
I guarantee you he will be there.
Yeah,
I feel like he'll be there. I'll see it on the Tuesday, so I'm hoping he's there too.
Just look for him watching movies at the Rio. He loves the Rio. So.
Nice.
So I co-sign pretty much all of your lists. Like honestly, I've selected five that I think are slightly more hidden gems, but the thing is like it's worth profiling some of these big movies that are hitting VIFF just because like. I love watching these films in a VIFF audience. Mm-hmm. Like it's a completely different experience watching something like Anora with a VIFF audience who knows what they're going in for, and is so open and receptive to it. And then you end up having such wonderful conversations with people after the film as well. So there's something really great about seeing a big movie, even if you know it's going to open up in regular theaters in a week or whatever. Doesn't really matter. Like seeing it with a VIFF audience, it really makes it worth it. But the five that I kind of selected to profile. So Steve, I'm with Chloe. I really want to see Seeds. Nice. I think Kenyetto Horn. I'm probably saying her name horribly wrong, but she's brilliant. So if you don't know her, if you saw Reservation Dogs, she played the deer lady in Reservation Dogs, which was one of the most incredible cameo characters in that whole series, which is incredible. She wrote and directed this film. So just really great. This is like her first major feature on her own. So I'm really excited to see what she presents. And it sounds like it's going to be like a really interesting story about evil multinational corporations and indigenous land stewardship, coming up against indigenous land stewardship. So it should be a pretty cool time. Like Steve, I'm a giant Alice Lowe fan. If you haven't seen Sightseers, you need to. If you haven't seen Prevenge, you need to. Prevenge is one of the most innovative horror/thriller-y movies I think that's ever come out. She filmed it when she was 7 months pregnant. Yeah, the film is brilliant. I'm so excited that she's finally put out another film. I didn't even like need to read the write-up. As soon as I saw Alice Lowe, I was like, that's it. I'm going to that movie. Another movie that I was super excited about is Matt and Mara, which is stars Matt Johnson and Dara Campbell, who both were together in a film that played at VIFF a few years back called Anne at 13,000 Feet. They have brilliant chemistry together. Razek Radwanski is the writer-director. I think this is going to be a really great film. And at 13,000 Feet really blew me away when it played VIFF. So looking forward to the follow-up. Another Canadian movie that I'm super excited about too is Paying for It. So this is a film that has been adapted by Sukhyun Lee. And it's based on a graphic novel by a brilliant Canadian cartoonist, Chester Brown. And he wrote the story. It's based on his own life of his experience paying sex workers for sex. And the book was really groundbreaking because of his honesty about his experience. And was also like huge in terms of advocating for sex worker safety and sex worker rights and arguing that sex work is work. It'll be really interesting to see how Sukhyun Lee takes this book and turns it into a film. And it sounds like she's injecting a bit more of her side of the story as his partner at the time. They had decided to kind of open their relationship up. And so she was his partner at the time that he was seeing sex workers. So should be a really interesting film. Sukhyun is a super interesting artist, very sex positive. Yeah, very excited to see what she does with this. And for my fifth selection, I chose Dahomey, which is the new Madi Diop film, which is a documentary, which is also really interesting. I loved Madi Diop's Atlantics. I thought it was such a brilliant, brilliant, atmospheric, romantic ghost love story with a lot of geopolitical commentary. Just a brilliant film. And this movie is about the repatriation of cultural artifacts from the Republic of Benin. Should be super interesting. She won the Golden Bear for Best Film for this film. At the Berlin Film Festival. So yeah, should be another interesting one. And I haven't seen it on a lot of lists yet, which surprises me. But I just think there's like so many cool things at VIFF. Like, I don't know, when I saw the program this year, I was really excited. Like, not just for the big stuff that's playing at the Playhouse, but lots of smaller films that were exciting, like the five I just mentioned. And then plus, I just want to give like an honorable mention to Esben's new film, Parvulos. Because he's another like brilliant.
Yeah, I'm gonna be seeing that one.
there's just so many cool. There's so many cool films at this year's festival. It's a pretty exciting program.
Yeah, and always great to do these lists because, like I said, I didn't really look at the program much deeper than I have in the last couple of years. So it's always great to be able to get some other context. And Matt and Mara is one that I've heard a lot about over the last couple of days because it did premiere at TIFF. And it's been very buzzy. And really, yeah. Matt Johnson is fantastic. So I'm excited to see that. Maybe not at TIFF, but definitely down the road.
Yeah, I'm seeing it there. Phenomenal. And the scene in Anne at 13,000 Feet that he and Dara Campbell shared together, like their chemistry is so great. Like I'm really looking forward to seeing like a full feature of the two of them. Cause it was like a really small scene in the other film of them together. So
that's awesome.
It'd be really great.
I get to watch that one at the Woodward building.
Nice. I don't mind that venue.
Right after the Tragically Hip.
I'm not seeing the hip thing. It's on Amazon on the 20th.
Yeah, I just figured I'd go because the hip's going to be there. Yeah, yeah.
I'm just not that big of a fan, to be honest. I was like,
I love the hip, so
One more Viv thing. Hello, Viv programmers. This is Bill speaking. If you could late add the Brutalist from Brady Corbet, that would be really great.
Yeah,
it doesn't have to be in 70mm. It can be in digital. I don't care. I just want to see it. Thank you.
I also want to say that because I have to leave in the afternoon of the Friday, that's why Night Bitch wasn't on my list. That's why The End wasn't on my list. Amelia Perez and Saturday Night. That's why all of those movies weren't on my list.
I would be remiss if I didn't highlight the two animated features at this year's festival, both of which I would highly recommend. The first is Flow, which world premiered at the Cannes Film Festival and has played pretty much every animation and large festival from here to eternity since January. That's Gintz Zilbadolis' new film. His movies never have any dialogue. It's just music and visuals. And Flow is brilliant. Highly recommend it. And then the second is Rock Bottom, which is Maria Trenor's new film. I think it might be her directorial debut for a full-length feature. She's animated some other short films in the past. Her films are always very provocative, very interesting. She has a very unique visual style. It's the story of Robert Wyatt told through animation. It's very psychedelic, has a very 70s sort of like I'm high feel to it. Definitely worth checking out. I would recommend both of those. They're both really, really solid and interesting non-Disney animated projects. they really do showcase the stories that you can tell via animation. So I highly recommend both of those. They're both very, very good. I would say Rock Bottom is not for kids. Flow is fine. Rock Bottom, not so much.
I'm going to Flow on the Sunday.
Yeah, you'll not be disappointed.
Also, the Canadian film contingent in VIF is so impressive, and it's
very good.
I know we sometimes have our differences about the state of Canadian film on this podcast, but I will say, like, because they get such little distribution, like, I just really appreciate living in a city that has a film festival that profiles Canadian films, because it can be so hard to watch these in any other market. So yeah, like, in addition to the ones that we've already talked about, like, there's also a new Guy Madden film that's going to be at VIF.
Rumors.
There's also a new Anne-Marie Fleming movie called Can I Get a Witness? Like, these are like powerhouses in Canadian cinema. There's a really interesting talk that they're doing with a young Indigenous animator named Amanda Strong in conversation with everyone's favorite matriarch of Indigenous cinema, Bonsoin. There's also, like, it's like the Alanisa Bumsawin year too. She's also going to be in performance with Jeremy Dutcher at the Chan Center as part of VIF, which I'm also really looking forward to. That's going to be an amazing show. It's a very cool festival. They've done a pretty good job this year. Good job, programmers at VIF.
It's shaping up to be a good festival.
Yeah.
And so the next time you hear from us will be during VIF, probably not opening weekend, probably pretty close to it. And hopefully we'll be coming at you with discussions, very quick podcasts from the ground. But Bill, Steve, I think now would be a good time for you to also plug the show that you do, because I have a feeling you guys are going to be recording more often than once a week during the festival. Am I assuming that?
Yeah, well, yeah, Chloe and I are going to be basically putting together a compiled video over the festival. I mean, as far as our show goes, we'll be releasing an episode this Friday, the 20th, of regular, like, What the Hell Should I Watch content. And then we're going to head on the hiatus to put this fifth project together. It's going to be cool. It's going to be cool. Cause the intent of the video is to come from Chloe's point of view as well. To be like the first timer, boots on the ground. And it's gonna be fun. I'm super psyched. So yeah, it'll be like a special What the Hell Should I Watch VIF edition, but it'll be compiled and probably will come out the finale weekend.
Awesome. So until then, folks, where can everybody find you?
I am Bill Harris. I am on Letterboxd and Twitter at SoundJam69. And in case anybody's curious, my schedule right now has 40 films on it. 40.
Nice.
Sorry, Melissa, go ahead.
I'm Melissa McDowell, and you can find me on Letterboxd at Melzy Melzy. My list is nowhere near Bill's because I don't have time off. So I'm watching movies outside of work hours. So I'm hitting 10 at least. 10 at least.
Yeah, I refuse to admit how many I have on my schedule because the reality is I might not make all of them. So I'll watch whatever I have the opportunity to watch. You can find me between now and then on Letterboxd at The Marina and on Instagram at The Marina 2. And that's pretty much the only two places you can find me. And last, but certainly not least.
I've got about 22 films, I think, on here. So it's all right. I'm at The Stevel Dead on Twitter, Instagram, Letterboxd, and Threads. You can find my website, stevestebbing.ca. It has the show that I mentioned on there, What the Hell Should I Watch, which is a weekly release that I do with my daughter, Chloe. Every Friday at 9 a.m. Pacific time is the release time. I'm also on Tremble with Kurt and Taylor. The last episodes we did were on Friday the 13th Part 2 and Friday the 13th Part 3. And I'm also on Shane Hewitt and the Night Shift, which is on the iHeartRadio network, News 1010 out of Toronto. That is Fridays at 8 p.m. Eastern time, and then it gets rebroadcast over the country. I'll use it here to announce I am now a new member of the Vancouver Film Critics Circle as of this week. A long journey for me to finally be part of that group, but they voted me in unanimously, so I feel
of really, course they
fucking,
did
it's about fucking real. Time is all I have to say.
I there were certain things that were keeping me out for a long time, but I was just persistent, I guess, and I have friends.
Good for you. Congratulations.
Elevating the critics circle.
I fully agree. 150%.
Thanks, guys. That means a lot to me.
Here's a weird question. Why aren't you in that, Marina? Just out of curiosity.
I don't know how to apply. Is this something that it comes down to? And I, at this point, I don't fucking care.
We're gonna talk to Mark about it.
Yeah, yeah. I'm at the point in my quote unquote career that I just don't care. I am okay being. I'm a member of the Alliance of Women Film Journalists, and for me, that was really the highlight of my career as a quote unquote critic, because to be recognized by that group was very, very important to me. But the circle, the Vancouver circle, I just don't care. I inquired about it a couple of years, about maybe a decade ago, when I was like in the knee deep of film criticism, and I just never got a response, and then I just didn't care. And now I really don't care.
I think I got rejected by the Cascadia one because I was in the process of getting Chloe all vetted, and we're all like new to our show and everything, and I just didn't have time to respond to it. And I think the organizers were just like, no, we don't want you then. So
And at this point, like, I was also a member of a Canadian film critics group that like died a year after it was formed. So these things come and go. It's, you know, it is what it is. And anyway, I'm mostly on the other side of the equation as a programmer now anyway, so it doesn't really matter. It's weird. It's weird. I am very happy for you, Steve, though. I think it's about time that organization feels like it has a lot of old blood in it. Mm-hmm. They really need some new, fresh voices. So I'm very glad that they finally saw it and were in the right mind to give you accreditation, because you should have been in that group a long time.
Thank you very much. I'm very proud of it.
Round of applause for you. Congratulations. Until the next show, you can find links to everything we talked about today at atcpod.ca. And like I mentioned, we'll be back in a couple of weeks with probably not this type of show. You might get a couple of like small shows. We don't know. It's a work in progress for VIF, but we will be at you very, very soon with some VIF content. So until then,
hack the planet.
Hack the planet.